final case of the day is United States against Andrews. Mr. Sullivan.
May it please the court, my name is Dennis Sullivan. I represent Anthony Andrews, who comes before this court today on his appeal of his sentence. Mr. Andrews was convicted of one count of mail fraud and was sentenced by the district court to 60 months. The district court imposed a two-level enhancement on that sentence on the basis of Mr. Andrews abused his position of trust, as a used car dealer.
How did that affect the the guidelines calculation?
My understanding, Judge, is that that would have increased the sentence by about 6 months.
6 months?
Correct.
Of course, the judge could very well impose the same sentence again, right?
Absolutely true, but I think the point here is that to classify this particular relationship
But my question is, now that the guidelines are advisory, is there a point in fussing about tiny guideline errors?
Well, as long as the guidelines
are... The judge obviously thought the sentence he gave was a right sentence. And now you come along and say, well, actually 6 months of it, no, I don't know, could have been mistaken application of the guidelines. But how likely is it that the judge would alter the sentence?
I don't know. I think it is important, though, that...
Did the two ranges overlap? That is, if you take the 2 points off, would the sentence still be within, would the actual sentence still be within the other range?
I don't know the answer.
We had a doctrine before Booker, the overlapping range doctrine, that unless the judge declared that it didn't make any difference which range it was, the sentence would be the same. We would remand to use the right range. I wonder whether after Booker that needs to be revisited.
I've not considered that.
We don't know whether this is within overlapping ranges.
I do not.
Reasonably,
I do not. If I may supplement with a letter brief after.
I appreciate learning whether an overlapping range was possible here.
Getting to Judge Posner's point, though, I think it is important. As long as a judge is still going to refer to the guidelines as the basis for imposing decision, I think it diminishes the court's integrity, the guidelines, everything, to say that things that aren't really called for under the guidelines are. And I think that's where we're at here. I mean, this is not this position as a used car dealer does not meet the
well,
standard.
Well, but he's licensed by the state. Seller, the person whose car has a lien on it, can't release that lien or cause that lien to be released, can he? He has to go through a dealer.
Absolutely right. But he has an absolute duty. There's no discretion here. That seems to be one of the main criteria for determining whether or not this level of enhancement is appropriate or not. There's no discretion. He has an absolute duty to satisfy lien. He didn't. I mean, but it is not a abuse of the trust. There's no trust here. He's not in the same position as a trustee or somebody who is given a great deal of discretion in terms of how to manage
trustees,
money.
Trustees may be saddled with the requirements and they are required to do something and don't do it. That's a breach of trust, isn't it?
Well, trustees stand in fiduciary relationship to their, beneficiaries.
This absolute no discretion, I don't think, really cuts. Because a trustee can have that same sort of relationship of being required to absolutely do something under the trust agreement, and he or she doesn't do it.
I think that the important thing there is whether or not there is discretion, whether or not the trustee has discretion with to manage the corpus of the trust.
I think you're conflating two things that are quite different, and that is. A trust in the trust law sense and an abuse of trust. They're quite different. You might trust someone to do something that was mandatory, and you would be hurt by having bestowed your trust in that person. That's different from entrusting someone with discretionary authority.
Well, it is, but I mean,
you don't need abuse of trust in a trust law sense to trigger the.
I think that the cases on this and the comments.
Or do you think? Maybe you do think that.
I'm sorry.
Maybe you do think that abuse of trust means that it's an abuse of a position as a trustee or some equivalent.
Well, I don't think that it has to be. I think that that's what the guidelines are geared towards.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, they talk about the discretion, the importance of discretion, the abuse of the discretion that this person.
But you can have someone who trusts you not because you have discretionary authority, but because of your status, the representations you make, right? You say, I'm a lawyer. You can trust me to do my mandatory duties.
But how is that different?
Wouldn't that be an abusive trust situation?
Well, that certainly would be. But how would that be
even
different?
Even though there'd be no discretion involved.
Well, but how?
That's why I think you've confused two senses of the word trust: the one in trust law and the one in ordinary language.
What you might want to emphasize is the position, the proposition that it has to be a position of trust, not an abuse of trust in that sense.
That was my point in response.
Position of trust. Your argument has to be that no used car dealer is ever in a position of trust as a matter of law.
That's headline material. I think that is true, and that is my point here. I mean, getting to Judge Posner's point, I mean, as far as the trust, I trust that people aren't going to go across the center line and smash into me as I'm driving down the road. They have licenses issued by the state. I trust that when they come across and hit me, is it a?
You must be extremely accident prone if you trust that.
So I think it is a focus on the relationship here, and the relationship in this is not a situation where Mr. Andrews was holding money for widows and orphans, or was holding money for his labor union, or was taking money from his relatives or family, or was an imposter, any of those kinds of things that have been found consistently to be to justify a two-level of enhancement. I mean, he is a used car dealer. These are arm's-length transactions. He has an absolute responsibility to pay off the liens. He didn't do it.
But the customers are trusting him to do that, aren't they? Because he's the businessman and he deals with the Department of Transportation and so on.
You know, but how is that different than the depositor giving money to the teller and trusting that the teller is actually going to deposit it in the account? And the comments to the guidelines specifically say that.
Well, that's a little different. But the used car dealer or new car dealer for that matter, he is dealing with the state, right? And so you're trusting him to carry out his duties to the state.
I would agree with that, but I don't think that just because you're trusting him to do that is the kind of trust that is anticipated by the guidelines for a two-level enhancement. I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Good morning. My name is Grant Johnson. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney representing the government. In this case, as the court just heard from Mr. Andrews' attorney, the issue here really is whether or not this is a position of trust. And when you look through the threads of the various cases that this court has decided previously in position of trust issues, really what we need to look to is to the relationship between the victim and the defendants. And when you look at the relationship in this particular case,
so what is your answer to the hypothetical about the teller? Right, you give your money to the teller, you trust the teller to, you know, put it in the right place in the bank, not put it in their pocket. Right.
The difference, sir, I think, was pointed out in the Lamb case, where that was a postal carrier case. And I'm trying to think of the Teller case, but I know they reviewed, they compared the postal case with the Teller case, and they concluded that in a Teller situation, you have supervision. The teller is there. There's supervision, direct supervision from a supervisor. And the second thing is that there's a check and balance. The drawer is reviewed every day. So I think it's a whole different kind of position. If you go one step above the teller, obviously, the supervisor, there's not that supervision and there's more discretion. In this particular case, the defendant was operating a one-man used car dealership in northern Wisconsin. He had direct contact with the victims. Unlike a number of the position of trust cases, you have big companies, you have a middle-level manager who is in contact with the victim. You don't have a position of trust because you don't
have...
Was
there anything the victims could have done to protect themselves?
If I was going to sell a car this way or buy a car this way, sell a car, I'd do something else. But the way the system was set up, the victims, first they trusted him. He was a friend. And the system set up by the state requires that he take the money to pay that lien off. So unless you're sophisticated or unless you've been burned once by a system like this, I'm not sure that there's any way...
So you say a sophisticated person would pay the lien off before selling the car?
Well, when I
might not have the money, though.
When I started this case, I had a Wisconsin Department investigator with me. We were talking about it, and I asked him that question. And he smiled, and he said, I'd take the money to the bank myself.
There apparently was somebody that found out about it, right? Checked with the bank later?
Yes, sir. Well, the bank found out about it about halfway through this scheme. There was about an excess of $1 million over the 5 years that he was able to use. He paid back all but, I think, about $500,000 of it. The big thing in this case, though, I think, is the relationship.
Well, who were the ultimate victors? Were they the people who had the liens? Or the people who sold the cars or bought the cars?
There's a myriad of victims because when he failed to take the lien off, the car was resold. But the initial victims were the people who came in, traded in a car with a lien, and expected him and gave him the money to pay off that lien.
But, I mean, are they victimized in the sense that the Leonore then came after them?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And if the court reviews the testimony of the one witness, I mean, that's exactly what happened to her. The one victim who testified.
Right.
They came back after her. She still owed the money.
Right.
But when you get down, I guess, to the bottom line of the case, is that you had a small community, and when you review the testimony of the one witness who testified at sentencing, she talked about the friendship that existed. So it was more than a commercial relationship. It was a person in a small community who established a position of trust, position of friendship, and took advantage of that position of trust and friendship. So I think the court was 100% correct in applying the enhancement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anything further, Mr. Sullivan?
Just very briefly, Your Honor, addressing the one point question to Mr. Johnson. I believe that as the victims here were the people who were ultimately liable on the loan that they had taken out for the car. But there's no, I guess my point there is that there was no discretion. He did not have any.
How do the victims verify compliance? The thing that worries me about your analogy to the bank teller is that, of course, the victim, the depositor, can verify the next day whether the teller has applied the funds correctly. But this seems to be a situation where verification is difficult, if not impossible, for an ordinary consumer, and therefore one might think this is more of a position of trust.
Well, I don't think it would be impossible. I think you'd verify it the same way that you'd verify the deposit in your account. You'd check with the bank and see if the lien had been satisfied. And in fact, I believe that happened in this case, and Mr. Andrews then paid off the loans on those particular where those kinds of inquiries had been made. So my time is up. Thank you.
Of course, with the bank situation, you're insured. I mean, you're protected, right?
Well,
so
I suppose it depends on how
to trust the teller because there are a lot. You don't have to trust the teller because you have a lot of other protections. Well, but you don't have that here.
I mean, there's a limit on your insurance at the bank as well. And
well, you're not going to hand the teller, you know, $110,000 in cash or something like that. So people are protected against dishonest tellers, but they're not protected against the dealer. Right?
I think that the
see, in a way, insurance and trust are they're substitutes for each other, right? So if you're insured, you don't have to trust someone. And if you're not insured, then you may have to trust someone. So then that person has a position of trust in relation to you.
My time is up. I don't know if you're if I may respond.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess.